As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is David Fivecoat. David served 24 years as a U.S. Army paratrooper, as well as four combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. And since leaving the Army, he founded the Fivecoat Consulting Group, where he helps develop gritty leaders. David is also the author of the book, Grow Your Grit, and he's here today to talk about developing personal grit. So welcome to the show, David.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm excited about this. I've listened to several of your podcasts, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you were able to make it on the show and come on and sharing your information as well, because I think the gritty side of things is something that's important. I think we all have the potential in us to have that gritty side of us come out. But it's just a matter of tapping into that, I think. And I think your experience with what you do now will be a good help there. But before we get into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background? And I know you and I both were in Afghanistan around the same time. I'd love to hear a little bit about where you were and what you did over there. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, no, that'd be fun. So a little bit about me. I grew up in Ohio, no military sort of background in the family, but decided to go to West Point because I loved reading military history. And of course, all the World War II generals had attended West Point, and it was really a good fit when it came time to apply to colleges. And that's how I ended up at West Point. And throughout my Army career, I was always of the sort of mind that, hey, I'll stick around in the Army until it stops being fun. And every couple of years, when it started to look like it wasn't going to be fun, there'd be a new job or a new challenge or something, and that kept me going. I did 24 years in the Army. I was commissioned as an infantry officer, and along the way, I had the opportunity to serve in Kosovo, Bosnia, three trips to Iraq, and a trip to Afghanistan. My final job in the Army was I ran the Army's Airborne School and Ranger School. And while I was had the oversight of Ranger School, we actually led the gender integration of Ranger School. And for your listeners that aren't familiar with Ranger School is the Army's premier small unit leadership school. It's been in existence since 1952. There's been about 80 or 90,000 graduates. And up until 2015, those graduates were all male. And in 2015, we ran a pilot program. 19 women came to Ranger School, and three women were the first three women to earn the Ranger tap. That was a pivotal part of the Army's decision to open all jobs and all units to women and provide equal opportunity to everyone that serves in the Army. Since then, since 2015, Ranger School has graduated almost 100 women and several thousand men in that same time frame.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask you if you had a frame of reference for how many women have made it through Ranger School in that time period, but you beat me to it, and you answered that question already. So, that's great, and you've definitely had quite the career with the deployments and all the experience that you have had. Tell me about this trip to Afghanistan that you did. Where you were, what your job was there, and everything. I always like to talk to people who were there around the same time that I was, and just hear their side of what they did there, because I have obviously my experiences, my perspective, but it's nice to hear from somebody else and hear what they went through and everything in that same time period, just to compare notes what that was like.
No, I was excited when I saw that you were there at the same time frame. We were both there during what was known as the Afghanistan surge, which was 2010. In 2009, I was fortunate enough to be selected to command 3rd Battalion, 187 Infantry, which is known as the Iron Rakasans. They're based at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Tremendous history and lineage, and had already by that point in time had done one trip to Afghanistan and three trips to Iraq. So we were on the fifth deployment as part of the Global War on Terror. And we were selected to go take over Western Paktika province, which if you're not familiar with Paktika, it's in the southeast corner of Afghanistan, part of the province borders Pakistan. My battalion was in an area about 100 miles north to south and about 50 miles east to west. And we arranged the four companies that each had a sector, and we did our best to work with our Afghan partners, both the Afghan government and the Afghan army and the Afghan police, to try to make Paktika a more safe and more secure environment. The Taliban had a few other ideas about that, and we got in some pretty tough fights along the way. And the battalion eventually earned the Valorous Unit Award for its actions there in Paktika. We had about 100 folks wounded, and unfortunately, three folks killed in the battalion. But it was about the same time you were there. And one question I'd like to ask you, I know you were up in Nangarhar, a little bit northeast of where I was, but what was one kind of cool story that you remember kind of fondly now?
No, looking back on, that's a good question. Looking back on that deployment, it's not necessarily a fond memory, this was a fun time or anything like that. But it was, to me, the thing that stood out was just the stark difference in the contrast between American lives and Afghan lives, and how we live just completely different lives, and the way we go about our day to day and the way they go about their day to day are just so polar opposite in a lot of respects. In some respects, they're very similar, but in a lot of respects, they're just so polar opposite. And when we come back home to the United States, we wouldn't want to change any of this for anything. Like we enjoy the luxuries that we have here and all that kind of stuff. But the people over there, they're content with how things are. A lot of them, they're content with, living in the villages that they live in, because that's where they've always lived, and it that's where their parents grew up, and that's where their parents, the grandparents grow up, and all that stuff, and they're just content with that. And when we think that we can talk to them and say, hey, well, it could be different, it could be all of this, and this is what you have to do to get that, and then they're like, well, but we don't want that, we want this, what we have, and this is how it is. And to me, it just stood out as a very different way of life and a different way of thinking, and especially when you're doing things like trying to win the hearts and minds of the people who are over there, you sort of have to understand their mindset and where they're coming from with a lot of this stuff. And so if you go in there with an American mindset of, oh, this isn't good enough, let's make this more like America, then you might not have a ton of success. And so it was very, very eye-opening when I went over there. But some of the things that were kind of funny that stand out and make me smile a little bit thinking back at it is just interacting with some of the kids there, because despite all that I just said, a kid's a kid. I don't care what country they come from or whatever. They're gonna be kids, and they're gonna horse around, and they're gonna have fun and everything. And just our interactions with them just would be funny. Sometimes they'd be little punks, but sometimes they'd be sweet and everything. And it was just a nice thing to see a little sense of normalcy in the midst of all the chaos that was going on over there at the time.
For some of your listeners that didn't serve in Afghanistan, the dichotomy where you would have folks living in mud and straw huts, and then they would have cell phones or motorcycles, and they lived in mud and straw huts for hundreds of years, and cooked fires right in the middle of the building, and maybe didn't have glass windows, but maybe had some sort of parchment or plastic over their windows. It was just an interesting sort of contrast. And I'm sure your company, I don't know how long that base was there, but you guys had a hard existence too, I suspect, there on your base. Different than what you're used to now in Arizona.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the climate, the temperature was very similar to what we have here in Arizona, but the way of life, the electricity instability, you're living in a plywood hut basically, and so it's definitely not the plush accommodations that you have at home that you're typically used to, but to your point about the people living in the mud huts and then walking around with cell phones, I've oftentimes described it as being dropped into like biblical times where it's like so ancient and so primitive the way certain people live, with the difference of they had cell phones, some of them had cars, and AK-47s and RPGs. That was the difference. Like, it was like basically shooting yourself back 2,000 years and just adding a few modern conveniences, and that was about it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I know. We both put in some hard work in Afghanistan, but one of the things that I think a lot of veterans, and I know I do, you sometimes think fondly about the experience, because a lot of, the deployments, and for folks that haven't deployed, things get sort of boiled down to their essence. You get up, you eat, you go on patrol, you work out, and you might call your spouse or significant other at the end of the night, and you go to sleep, and you repeat, and things get aren't a whole lot of options, where here in the United States there's lots of options, and things can get very complex very quickly because it's tough to figure out which option to pick.
Right. Yeah, your options are very limited. You could go exercise if your base was lucky enough to have a gym of some sort that you can go lift weights or whatever at, or you figure out some other way to exercise, because you still have to stay in shape. You can't just let yourself, go to weight, even though you're out patrolling all the time and you're probably okay with some of the cardio aspect of things, cause you might be running around and doing stuff, but you still have to maintain some sort of physical fitness regimen. If for nothing else, for your own sanity, to keep your head on straight, because it's so, like you said, there's very few options over there, and there's only so many $5 movies you can get from the local bazaar to occupy your time, and so many motion sick videos that you can watch as the guy's holding the camera in the theater and it's all bouncing around and everything. So
yeah, for the listeners that aren't familiar, they have knockoff DVDs or bootleg DVDs were super cheap in 2010, and you could get the latest movies because someone would go in and film them guerrilla style in the theater, and then they would mass produce them on DVDs, and you could get them. And sometimes there'd be a soundtrack, sometimes there wouldn't be a soundtrack. And especially if it was very early on the movie's release, they would get better as the movie's been out a while.
Right. And sometimes it was in the wrong language when you got it. And then you have to, all right, who speaks French? Let's get someone out here to translate this thing. It's like, what are you doing, guys? Come on.
So one time we had a bunch of Afghan senior officials, and a sandstorm rolled in, and we were like, well, what can we do with these guys? Because they were scheduled to get on this helicopter, and we were going to fly them back to the capital of the province, which was Sharana, and let them go back to their business. And we're like, well, what can we do with them? We're like, well, let's show them a movie. And between the interpreters and the soldiers, they came to a consensus to show them Transformers. Okay. And these are like 40 or 50 year old Afghan men. And at one point in time, one of the Afghan men asked the interpreter, is this real? And I was like, you guys picked like the absolute, you know, biggest sort of culture shock kind of movie you could show these guys, you know, totally not what life is like in Afghanistan. They all picked it because they thought that the guys would appreciate, was it Megan Fox is the actress in it. They thought that they would all appreciate seeing Megan Fox in it, but the vehicles that turned into robots and fought other robots was a little bit of a stretch for them.
That's funny. Yeah, and I remember talking to some of our interpreters or other Afghan people through the interpreters, and they had a skewed sense of what was real in the United States. It was kind of like the stories that you might have heard of the immigrants coming to America, in the early part of the last century, and saying that the streets were paved with gold and all that kind of stuff, where they had these grand ideas of what America was like. And it's like, well, no, that's a stretch. Like, some of these things are not exactly entirely true. So, asking if, you know, that type of thing is real, it's obviously, to us, it's obviously not, but to them, they probably have never seen something like that in their movies that they may have had, if they even had movies to watch. You know, that's the other thing to consider.
Right, right. That was maybe not one of the better selections that we could have picked. Maybe next time we'll get it better.
Yeah, I mean, I could think of other movies that would be just as bad, you know, The Terminator or something like that, where, you know, things would probably freak them out a little bit. It's probably more of a horror movie to them.
Right.
But, well, let's jump into this topic of grit and get into that a little bit. But before we do, let's start with a definition. Like, let's define what, to you, what grit is, and, you know, what personal grit is, and how do we get it, or how do we grow it if we already have it?
Yeah. So one part of the story we didn't get to, we got a little bit sidetracked in Afghanistan, which is fine. It's fun. It was fun to reminisce and talk about Afghanistan. In 2017, I transitioned out of the army and started working for a company doing leadership training with individuals. In March of 2020, at the beginning of the pandemic, I decided I should found my own company. I like to joke that I wasn't feeling like I was gritty enough. So I decided to found my own company at the beginning of the pandemic and go out on my own and start doing executive coaching and leadership training with mainly corporate groups. And I've now done that for the past 2 years. I've had the chance to grow a company. And there's been some interesting sort of contrasts. You know, you've spent a lot of time in corporate America. I went to college at West Point, then 24 years in the Army. So for 28 years, I had a government check coming in twice a month. And it was a big leap to first work for this small company as an independent contractor and then stand up my own company. In late fall, early winter of 2020, a client I was talking to said, "Hey, you're kind of gritty. Why don't you write a book on grit?" And I was like, "Huh, yeah, that is kind of interesting. You know, you're right. You know, I've had these gritty experiences, and maybe I've got something that I can help others try to develop it." And the definition that I have for grit is the will to persevere to achieve long-term goals. Now, it's slightly different. Some of your listeners have probably heard Angela Duckworth. Angela Duckworth is sort of like the godfather of grit. She's a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania. She's got a TED Talk and a book. But I read her book and I came away from it thinking she did a fantastic job defining it, telling you how to measure it, telling you who's got it, who doesn't. But I thought she fell a little bit short on creating a framework for somebody to develop their own grit in pursuit of a goal. One of the more challenging aspects in life is life is sort of a gritty journey. You don't know where you're going. You may have these aspirations, but you don't know exactly what to do. Along the way, there's lots of sort of structure kind of things. You know, if you decide to go to college, you know, there's sort of a four-year plan. You have to take X number of classes. You got to get this grade in it. And then you come out the other end and you get a degree. But there are some things in life where there's not a good roadmap. And in that, the things with a roadmap, it does help to have grit. And those without a roadmap, it really helps to have grit because you need to have a framework to help yourself get better. I think grit, you've got to have a couple of things. The number one thing I think that helps you develop grit is having a personal purpose and understanding what your why is. And it's a tough exercise. I just put six corporate executives, senior executives at this company through their personal purpose exercise. And every single one of them said, "Man, this is hard," because we don't typically take that introspection and go, "Hey, what am I all about? What are the values that are the most important to me? And how am I living those?" Then the second part of developing your grit is to do goal setting. And one of the challenges, I got a good question for you. Did you decide to do a New Year's resolution?
I didn't. I actually had a New Year's resolution years and years ago. I don't even remember when it was, to not make New Year's resolutions going forward.
Now, well, you honored that.
And I have so far. I've stuck with it, and the reason why is because I didn't like the mindset of taking an arbitrary date on the calendar and saying, "Okay, I'm going to start on this date, and I'm going to get better at whatever, you know, whether it's fitness, or you know, I want to read a book every so often, or if I want to do something, I notice that there's something I want to improve in myself. I'm going to just start it. I'm going to start it now, or, you know, like come up with a goal and a plan and say, okay, this is when I'm going to do it. I don't care if it's in August or if it's in January or whatever." So that's kind of been my mindset, is if I see something that I want to improve on in any area of my life, I'm going to just start it. And so I tend to not do New Year's resolutions just so that I don't fall into that trap of being in, you know, November and saying, "Oh, I probably should lose a few pounds. But you know what? I'll just wait until January and I'll join the gym then." And all that kind of stuff, you know? So no, I haven't done a New Year's resolution, but to that point, doesn't mean that I don't see areas in my own life that, that do need improving and that I do work on from time to time.
Yeah. Well, we're recording this on January 24th. So a lot of folks right now are struggling with their New Year's resolutions and maybe about ready to give them up, whatever they are. And I found, you know, one of the biggest challenges with New Year's resolutions is that folks don't do adequate goal setting. You know, the goal for a New Year's resolution or any sort of goal, you know, the best tool is the mnemonic device SMART. And SMART stands for specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. And the three most important parts of it, whenever you set a goal, is, hey, is it specific? What am I trying to accomplish? The second part is measurable. How am I going to measure this? What do I say success looks like? You know, it's easy if we're dropping 10 pounds, right? Because you say, okay, I'm going to use the scale. I'm going to weigh myself right now, and I will weigh myself in the future and hopefully I've dropped 10 pounds. And then time bound, you got to set a goal, a date for the goal to be accomplished by. And if you don't have those three parts in your goal, you really need to go back and look at the goal. The second part of goal setting, which is also incredibly important, is you've got to schedule time on the calendar for it. You know, I'm sure all your listeners are busy. They've got things on the calendar, right? You know, their lives are busy. If you're going to add something new to the calendar, you got to look and go, okay, where am I going to actually accomplish it? If you put it on the calendar, it's more likely to happen. And then you've got to take the next step and say, okay, what am I going to take off in order to give myself space to actually accomplish this? And so those three things, using the smart mnemonic device, making sure you put it on the calendar, and then also taking a look and saying, what am I going to take off in order to be able to accomplish this, really sets you up for a better chance of actually accomplishing your goals.
Yeah. And that does make sense, because going back to the New Year's resolution discussion that we were just having, if someone's goal is to drop 20 pounds, that's specific, it's measurable. But if their goal is to do it in the first 2 or 3 weeks of the year, that's not very attainable. That's not something that you're practically going to be able to do, you know, unless you completely starve yourself, but that's just not healthy. And that's not what anyone should be focusing on doing. So, you know, I think that makes sense in being able to get those goals set in a manner that is achievable, that will set you up for success. You don't want to set unrealistic goals for yourself and make it so that you feel like, oh, you're failing at this, when you kind of didn't give yourself a chance to succeed to begin with, when you had unrealistic expectations of yourself, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that you've got to consider, after you get a good goal, you know, you've figured out your personal purpose, you've developed this goal that sort of complements your personal purpose, is to take some time and think about your resilience. And how are you going to most folks, if they consider it a gritty goal, it's something that really pushes the boundaries, it's out of their comfort zone, and it really, you know, is something that's going to move the needle, like starting a new company in the middle of the pandemic, or writing a book, or any of those things that you might decide to do. And inevitably, there's going to be a setback that happens along that way. And the first thing to think about when you're thinking about your resilience is, okay, I need to think through what are the most likely setbacks that are going to happen and how am I going to respond to them. Then the second part is making sure that I think one of the most important things with resilience is making sure that you are physically the best person you possibly can be. You know, that you are getting enough sleep at night, you're eating right, you're doing physical fitness, and you're taking a little bit of time for mindfulness. Those four things together really help, you know, increase a person's resilience. You know, think about the last time when, you know, maybe you were staying up late coding, or something like that. What sort of happens at night? You know, you're going to go, you know, you're going to snack more, you're going to do other things that may not be getting you to your goal of, you know, losing those 20 pounds. Or something like that. So you've got to think, hey, how have I created it so I've got the most opportunity to bounce back from these failures that are going to happen along the way? And how am I going to learn from them? The other thing is changing your mindset. Hey, it's one of the big things that for me, at least, was, you know, it's succeeding and then learning. It's not succeeding or failing. It's succeeding or learning. For instance, when I started out with the company, I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to try this for a year. I've never, you know, never stood up a company. I have no idea how this is going to go, but I'll do it for a year. And at the end of the time, if I haven't succeeded, it's okay, because I've learned new things. I learned how to put together a website. I run my own email list, and all those things that I had to teach myself along the way. I'm a much better person, and I continue to learn and grow and develop and move forward, even in my 40s and 50s.
Yeah. And, you know, I've used this example before on this podcast and other talks that I've done, but when you're talking about that resilience and that you know, that keep going kind of effort, I just think about my own kids as they were growing up and doing things that were outside of their comfort zone. Even something as simple as learning to ride a bike without the training wheels on. It was scary for them. It was definitely outside of their comfort zone. And they fell and they scraped their knees and they cried about it and they didn't like it and it was hard, but you keep encouraging them to get back on the bike and try it again and try it again and try it again. And just like you said, it's not a failure, it's a learning lesson. And so they learned, okay, if I lean too much this way, I'm going to fall. So, okay, don't do that again. If I lean too much the other way, I'm going to fall too. And okay, don't do that again. And eventually they figured out how to balance themselves and they did it. And now they ride their bikes like it's nothing. It's just one of those experiences that made that really hard and scary thing to them at that time now into a fun and enjoyable activity. And so if you are resilient enough and you're able to push through those learning lessons, not failures necessarily, you're able to get a more positive outcome from whatever it is that you're trying to achieve. You know, in this case, it was a simple example of riding a bike, but for a young kid, that's a hard thing to do. And so that does make it more of a resilient thing. You can't expect them to be doing things that a 40 or 50 year old would be able to do at that point. Right.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things the 30 or 40 or 50 year old sometimes forgets is the amount of learning and the failures that came along the way as they achieved other things, as they look back, because we all, as we age, you know, forget the bad stuff, remember the good stuff. Right. You know, I suspect both of us at various points in time were thinking, man, Afghanistan really sucks. And this is bad. And now as I look back on it, it's sort of like, oh yeah, it wasn't that bad.
Well, yeah. And something interesting that you said earlier in the episode that your goal was to basically stay in the Army until it stopped being fun. And then I looked back at my notes and I said, wow, you spent an awful lot of time in the Army for something that definitely could have been not too much fun for a period of that time. So, but yeah, exactly. I think you're right with that, where, you know, you do tend to remember the positive side, the benefits, and you might not remember the struggle quite as much, the downside. Like, you know, I can think back to when I started my business, and I remember that first client that I landed, and the first money that started trickling into the bank account, and that was like an incredible feeling, but the late nights and the hard work and everything that went into that I still remember it, but it's not the thing that pops to the front of my mind when I think about when I first started my business. So, so I definitely get where you're coming from with that.
Yeah.
When you were in the Army, what were some of your grittiest experiences? The things that really stood out to you?
I'll talk about two of them. Well, can I do three?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So three. The first one on a personal level was going through the U.S. Army Ranger School. Came out of the basic course as a young second lieutenant and shipped off to Ranger School. And Ranger School is 60. It's now 61 days. It was a little bit longer in that time frame. But Ranger students are stressed out through limited food and limited sleep. The average Ranger student loses about 20 pounds while they're there at Ranger School, and they operate on about 3 hours of sleep a night for the entire 61 days. And one of the things that happens while you're there at Ranger School is you get evaluated by a Ranger instructor, and whether you get a pass or a fail determines whether you're going to actually graduate or move on to the next phase. And I made it all the way to Florida, which is the last phase of Ranger School. And I made it successfully there without any hiccups. And I go through the Florida phase, and I come out of it, and they say, "Hey, Ranger, you're a no-go. You failed to lead your patrols, your two opportunities to lead patrols to the right standard that we expect. Do you want an opportunity to recycle?" And man, at that point in time, my parents were coming down for graduation and girlfriend, right, and all kinds of stuff. And I was like, "Well, yeah, I guess you got to do it." And you know, that sort of overcoming adversity and dealing with that failure. And you know, frankly, it was one of the first times that I really failed at anything significant. And then the second time was Iraq in 2007, 2008. I was a brigade operations officer for one of the brigades that got sent over for the Iraq surge. It was a 15-month deployment. We stood up a FOB from nothing and an entire brigade footprint from nothing. And it was a struggle. We got accelerated on our deployment, had an exceptionally tough boss. And it was just one of those sort of grinds for 15 months to get through. That really tested me as a person and as an organizational leader, because the boss was tough for folks to work for, had to help, smooth out some things, for him, and help keep the team all rowing together, as we tried to overcome things as part of the Iraq surge. And then the last one was leading, the Ranger School during the gender integration. There was a lot of resistance to change, lots of folks that were against it. And as the brigade commander, I was sort of the lightning rod for a lot of the folks that were irritated with allowing women the opportunity to come to Ranger School, and weathered that, like I said before, under the resilience side of grit, I had to develop a thick skin, a lot of learning opportunities. Lots of folks weren't happy with what I was doing, and it was in the public eye. The New York Times, Washington Post, Defense One. We're all having reporters follow this along. And so any misstep was magnified. And so lots of learning lessons there, and learned a lot about myself and resiliency there.
Yeah, I imagine that you would. And I was actually thinking that would probably be one of your answers to that question, because that had to be difficult, where there would be that resistance to that change, longstanding tradition, men only, and then now all of a sudden it's wide open to the women, and that probably would be make a lot of people kind of hesitant to that type of change, and may come to you as if this was your thing, and you masterminded this whole plan and everything, and you were the face of it, like any good soldier does, you're following orders, and this was your job, basically. So it's not like you needed to have that any kind of personal attacks or anything like that, because that what good does that do for anyone, really, at that point, right? So, regardless of what your beliefs are, or your opinion is on women in the Rangers or whatever, you're just doing your job at that point. So, I figure that would probably be one of the things that you were talking about in terms of your gritty experiences, because I can't imagine that would have been an easy thing to do, and it probably required quite a bit of grit to accomplish. So, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, no, it was an amazing experience, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to go through it. Two comments. First off, I was lampooned by Duffelblog twice during that experience, and so I consider that a career highlight that I made it into Duffelblog twice. The first one was that I was going to institute the pickle jar opening test as part of the Ranger School curriculum. The other one was after we had a bunch of Rangers hit by lightning while the women were there. The other thing I would be remiss if I did not talk about it, but the three women that graduated and earned their Ranger tab, which was Kristen Grice, Shay Haver, and Lisa Jaster, they had incredible grit. They persevered against odds. They were glass ceiling breakers. And one of the more interesting stories out of it, part of Ranger School is you have to do a 12-mile foot march with it's about 60 pounds of gear. You have to do it in 3 hours. It's an out 6 mile, turn around, come back in 6 mile. Kristen Grice, on her third time through the bending phase of Ranger School, because she went through it once, failed, went through it twice, failed, got the opportunity to take a day one recycle. And on her third time through, she actually finished third overall out of about 180 Ranger students in the road march. It was one of the tipping points and one of the things that started establishing credibility within the Ranger instructors, and a little bit wider than that, when folks heard, hey, you know, she finished third overall in the road march. It's a testament to their grit. They had an incredible amount of grit, super proud of them. They've all three gone on and done great things in the Army and out of the Army. They've represented Ranger School and the Army exceptionally well.
Yeah, that's great that was able to be displayed, you know, through those individuals. You know, honestly, anyone who's made it through Ranger School, male or female, I think is, has their own level of grit to get through that, because it's not an easy school to go through. But especially for the first females to go through, I think that's one of those things where you probably, and this is actually going to lead into my next question that I have for you, but you probably have that self-doubt and that fear of failure. You don't want to be the first woman to go through Ranger School and also be the first woman to fail going through Ranger School. So how can grit help someone overcome that fear of failure when trying to accomplish these big goals that they may have?
Yeah. You know, that's one of the components that I talk about in the book on grit. How do you deal with the fear of failure? Because if it is a gritty goal, undoubtedly, once again, you're pushing boundaries. It's out of your comfort zone, and you're risking something. You know, the military approaches risky situations differently. I don't know if you went through airborne school, but one of the ways, you know, that in airborne school you try to get over folks' fears of jumping out of planes is, you know, there's this sort of group approach to it, and you have a jump master that yells out commands, and the entire aircraft echoes those commands. And that's one of the ways, and you've got this whole ritual that you've gone over and you do the exact same way every single time. Well, that doesn't translate well to things that aren't this group activity. It works great in getting you to jump out of a aircraft. And I had the opportunity to do that over 100 times in the Army, but still was scared. Don't get me wrong. But one of the best things that I think is a way to deal with your fears is when you're going after these big goals, is you have to list your fears, and you've got to acknowledge that they're there. And these fears will manifest themselves in different ways. It's not like you're scared, but you know, you may see yourself procrastinating. You may see yourself, you know, getting distracted or doing other things. And that's how your fear sort of manifests itself. And the best tool that I've found for folks is to list their fears and then list what's the worst thing that can happen because of that fear, and then a mitigating strategy to help you deal with that fear. And I'll give an example. When I founded the company in 2020, I said, hey, what's the worst that can happen? And the worst thing that I had to happen is, like, you know, nobody's interested in buying what I'm selling. I don't make any money off of it. And, you know, I end up significantly poorer than I started out when I founded the company. Like, okay. And then I was like, okay, well, what's my mitigation strategy? And my mitigation strategy was, hey, I'm going to do this for a year. And at the year mark, I'm going to take stock and evaluate it. And if it's going well, I'll continue it. If it's not, I will fold up shop and go find a different job and put my resume out there and go find something else to do. And so fortunately for me, I got to March of 2021. The business had picked up some consulting contracts and some clients, and things were rolling along. And I said, okay, well, I'll stick this out for another year. And we're closing in March of 2022. I'll have to take an evaluation on it at that point in time. But things are going pretty well right now. And I think I'll keep doing it for one more year.
So you'll pencil in another year for that. Okay, good.
You may see some parallels between that and the, hey, I'm going to stick around in the Army till it stops being fun kind of approach to my life in the Army. Similar in business.
And fun is a relative term too, because you can enjoy things that other people might think suck. And, you can have fun. You may enjoy going on long ruck marches or whatever. And other people might be like, that's for somebody else. That's not me. Or you may enjoy jumping out of airplanes. And I've always said, I haven't gone through airborne school, but I've always said to people, if I go up in a perfectly good airplane with a perfectly good parachute, I'm going to land in a perfectly good airplane with a perfectly good parachute.
Yep.
Because I would much rather land that way than on my feet. So that's just me. If my job was going through airborne school, I probably would not make it too long, because that fear of heights is just too intense with me, and it probably wouldn't work out. But I did like what you were saying about that fear of failure and having those mitigation strategies in place. And obviously it's going to be different for every situation that you're going through starting a business. You want to know, okay, if in the absolute worst case scenario and you make no money over the next however many months, how long can you go? Like what kind of savings do you have? What kind of, financial resources do you have available to you, that you can put towards this so that, you can still keep the lights on and put food on the table and things like that and provide for your family. Because that's a very scary thing to wake up one morning and see, a negative bank account balance because you've overdrawn your account because now you haven't made money in the last 6 months, 9 months, or whatever. So knowing that you had enough money to last you a certain amount of time gives you that goal. It's like, okay, well, if I can't make anything in the next year, let's say, then I'm gonna have to do something else. But that at least gives you an opportunity to try something that's new, maybe a little scary, pushes you outside of the comfort zone. But it lets you do that without really worrying too much about the failure side of things, because worst case scenario, you can always find something else. Right.
Right. Well, in newfound appreciation for small business owners and the amount of risk that they take in, because if you don't have a client coming in the front door, you're not making payroll. You're not building your business. You're not putting food on the table. And I went the entire third quarter of 2020 without a client. And a lot of times I'm like, hey, this is as scary as some things that I went through in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I didn't appreciate that until I became a small business owner. I think you've got that same sort of perspective now. And I don't know if it was the same for you with you starting up your business, but it's tough.
Yeah, and when I started my business, I was the between my wife and I was the only one who was working, and she was staying at home with the kids. We had her here at home, and it was kind of scary because in the first couple months, it wasn't like money was just pouring in. Anyone who just starts a business knows that it's usually pretty slow in the first couple months. And then things started to pick up a little bit and got a little bit better. But, in those first couple months, it was kind of a nail biter. Like I didn't know how much longer I'd be able to continue doing it, because, I did have to put food on the table. I had to provide for my family and my wife, my three kids. And, you know, if I couldn't bring the money in, I had to figure it out some way. So, so it definitely could be scary. And we think about making it successful in terms of just the financial aspect, but you know, like how much money you take in, but there's a ton of other things that as a small business owner, you have to be responsible for as well. Insurance and you know, all that kind of stuff are things that you need to worry about, where if you had a corporate job somewhere, you get these benefits of, you know, your health and dental and vision and all these other benefits that come along with it. But now you're the sole person responsible for it. And so that gives you a lot more to think about. It's not just doing the same job that you would have been doing had you been working for somebody else. You have a ton of other things that you have to worry about as well. So yeah, it's difficult. It's scary at times, but I wouldn't trade it for any other experiences, because I think I've learned so much and grown so much professionally that I don't know that I'd be able to do that working for somebody else, you know? Someone who we were talking about, like the goal setting before, mm-hmm. Some of those specific, measurable, actionable, achievable goals. You know, how can someone do a better job at goal setting to accomplish their goals? What are some tips, like, you know, quick tips that maybe they might be able to use to accomplish some of these goals?
Yeah, you know, another idea that works really well for a lot of stuff, and especially for myself, is to break the goal down into smaller pieces. I'm big on having to-do lists, and I've always got a to-do list. But I find myself not making progress on a bigger goal if I don't break it down into several smaller goals and go, okay, you know, today I'm gonna, you know, read this article, tomorrow I'm going to write the blog post, the day after I'll edit it and whatever. But to break it down into smaller pieces is one key thing. The other one that I think is incredibly powerful is the power of the streak. And I don't know if it works for you, but there's you know, you can see it, you know, down to the simplest, you know, with the, you know, the fact that if you've got a Fitbit or an Apple Watch or a Garmin, you know, you're tracking your steps every day and you're trying to, you know, see if you can get to that magic number. And, you know, you like to see that you're on a streak and you've continued to, you know, walk X number of steps every day for the last, you know, 288 days. But that idea of a streak and actually doing something, and one of my New Year's resolutions this year was to do Dry January, which is you try not to drink alcohol during the month of January. And I had done it last year, so I figured, hey, it's not that big a deal. But, you know, today is January 24th. I have successfully made it 24 days without drinking alcohol, and I'm probably not going to mess up and drink alcohol these last 7 days because I've got this streak going. And that's another sort of simple tool to think about. You know, take it to a little bit bigger level. When I was writing the book, my goal was every day to do something for 15 minutes on the book. And most days I did a lot more than 15 minutes. But my minimum standard was, hey, I'm going to do 15 minutes on something. And it could have been as simple as like looking for pictures or formatting a slide or editing a chapter or writing a chapter. But I had to do something every day until I at least got the book to a point where I was happy with it and could send it out to some friends and then eventually send it out to a professional editor. But those kind of things, that idea of using that streak as a way to help you get closer to your goal is incredibly powerful. As I get older, same thing with physical fitness. I tend to not like to be, you know, there's some folks that advocate, well, you know, you should work out 6 days a week and take a day off. As I get older, I'm like, I gotta do something. And maybe it's just walking that day, or maybe it's just stretching. But I have found that getting off the bandwagon as it would be a physical fitness or in the case of the book or whatever, makes it exceptionally tough to get back on and get yourself moving towards that goal.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I know exactly what you're saying. And for the people who are listening, they probably couldn't see my reaction, but when David started saying some of the things that he was just talking about, I had a big smile on my face because I knew exactly what you're talking about. So a few years ago, I had a goal that I set for myself that I wanted to do 50,000 push-ups and 50,000 sit-ups in the course of a year. Whatever day I started it on, I wanted to do it, you know, by that day the following year. And so, like what you said, I divided it out, 50,000 divided by 365 days. And I said I needed to, and that worked out to like 137 or something like that, repetitions I needed to do every single day. It didn't mean I had to do them all in one sitting. You know, I could do 10 now, I could do 10 later, I could do, you know, as long as at the end of the day, I've done 137-ish, you know, push-ups and sit-ups, then I'd be on track to meet my goal. There were a few days that, you know, maybe I got sick and I just wasn't able to because I wasn't going to be doing sit-ups if I was going to be throwing up all over the place. So,
that's not a good sit-up.
Yeah, no, those are not the ones that I wanted to do. So, you know, so then after I felt better, I knew that I had to do, you know, if I was out for a day or two, I knew I had to make those up. And so I wouldn't necessarily do double the next day, but I would break that out over the next week, and I would do you know, however many I missed, I'd add that up, and so that way I'd get back on track. Even though I knew I fell behind, I'd be able to get back on track. And so I made it so that I could get on track, and I made it a daily thing. I set forth every single day I was going to do that, and I did it, and at the end of that year time period, I achieve that goal, and I hit that 50,000 mark, and it was something that was it was easier to achieve because I had that goal. But also, there's if anyone is interested in learning a language, there's an app called Duolingo, and they do the same thing that you were just talking about, where they provide a streak for the number of days in a row that you've practiced whatever language. It doesn't matter if you have multiple languages, if you've gone through all of one language, like if you've gone through all of Spanish or all of French or whatever, and then you move on to another language, it keeps that same streak going for you. But it's one of those things where I think I'm now at like 930 days or something in a row that I've used this app every single day. No matter what I had going on that day, I still found 10 or 15 minutes to sit down and open it up and practice something. So I made it all the way through the German course in there. I've started the Spanish course, which I took Spanish in high school and, you know, earlier in school. So I had a good foundation for that, but I wanted to challenge myself with something that I never did before. And I'd never spoke any German before. And I went all the way through the course from beginning to end. And now I have a decent understanding of the language, but you're right. That streak and that consistency really, really helped with that.
Right. And the toughest part is actually starting that streak. You know,
yeah.
The first day that you did Duolingo, you probably weren't thinking that you were going to get to 967 or whatever the number is right now. But once you overcome that, your internal resistance to it, and can get that streak going. And what I've found is usually it's at about the 2 to 3 week mark. If you can get a streak past 3 weeks, you can pretty much sustain it for a while because you've established that habit. It's a new and different habit. And I'm sure there's nights where it gets to be like 10 o'clock and you're getting ready for bed and you're like, darn it, I did not do Duolingo today.
Right.
I need to go knock out my 10 minutes.
Yeah. And it's like an itch that you just can't scratch. And then it's like, oh, I got to do something about this. Right. And so you're right. Yeah. And so that is one way to stay stay consistent with it is having that streak that you, whether it's an app that keeps track of it for you, or you just know that, okay, did I exercise today? And, you know, you don't need an app to tell you that. You can do that pretty easily on your own, or whatever it is for the goal that you have. You just do it consistently. And even, like I said, 10 minutes a day, is enough to learn that particular language over a period of time. And so it doesn't have to be this huge, long 3-4 hours of whatever. You just set these small goals and break it up into bite-sized pieces, and you'll get there eventually at some point. You know, it depends on what it is, how long it'll take you, but you'll get there, you know.
Right. And, you know, what is it? The great is the enemy of good, or whatever. And
yeah,
doing 10 minutes a day is so much easier, than trying to find the perfect 4 hours to write a book or do a language or whatever. And so just say, hey, look, I'm doing 10 or 15 minutes of whatever it is. If you can't, you've got to be able to find the time to do that. And you can do it. I do think the visual aspect of Duolingo, where you can actually see your streak, you know, physical fitness, you can remember, but sometimes, especially if you're trying to start a new habit, it helps to at least have a physical calendar and maybe put an X on every day that you worked out, or use some sort of app that actually helps you track that kind of streak, because it helps to remind you when you get to the 967th night and you're like, darn it, I got to go do my 10 minutes. So you don't blow that streak.
Yeah. Cause that's the last thing I want to do right now. I don't want to lose that streak. It's like in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter. Like, I've achieved quite a bit with it, but if it goes back down to zero, I'd be so pissed at myself.
Right. I have found, you know, like when I blow a streak for whatever reason, you know, travel or whatever, it is so much it's so much tougher to get back on the wagon and start that streak again, because I was at 500 nights of, you know, getting my 10,000 steps in, and now I blew it because something happened.
Something comes up. Right. Exactly. So I want to give you a few minutes to talk about your book and tell us about that, where people can find it and what it's all about.
Yeah. So the book is called Grow Your Grit. It came out in July. It's available on both Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Amazon, it's had 21 five-star reviews so far. And so I hope people, your listeners, go find it on either of those websites and take a look at it. And hopefully it gives them some ideas on how to enhance their personal grit and helps them accomplish some of their bigger goals. That is the first half of the book. And then the second half of the book is, if you're a leader of an organization, how do you incorporate grit and develop grit into that gritty organization? And so there's two parts of the book. I hope it helps your listeners. I hope one person out there takes a look at it. I hope it helps them grow their personal grit and accomplish some of their goals.
Yeah, I do too. And I will have links to the book in the show notes. So anyone who's listening to this, check out the show notes for that information, where you can find the book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, or you can just go and search for it on there like you would for any other book. But a nice, quick, and easy link I'll put in the show notes for you. David, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today and chatting about grit. I'm sure we probably could keep going and talking for quite a while here, but where can people go to get in touch with you and find out more about your consulting and the type of work that you do for organizations?
Yeah. So I have a website, thefivecoatconsultinggroup.com. Google it. It shows up in all the Google searches. You can check out my services page and see if executive coaching might be right for you or your team. I host some offsites that are leadership opportunities to help grow the leadership of teams. And then I also go and do keynote speeches and workshops at organizations. Would love to help your team out or you individually as a executive coach. And so if folks would check it out on the website at thefivecoatconsultinggroup.com, would love to have an opportunity to talk to them and see what their challenges are and see if I might be able to help them.
Excellent. Yeah. And I will have a link to that in the show notes as well. Again, go check that out. If that sounds like something that would benefit you or your organization, check out his website and book some time with David to help out you and your organization. So again, David, thank you for joining me on the show today. I'm really happy that we got a chance to chat and look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And thanks for all the things that you're doing for the veterans out there with this podcast. I know I enjoyed the couple of sessions that I got to listen to some of your guests, and they gave me some good ideas on things to do. And so thanks again for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.